The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. As our name indicates, we cover the world of books and film. We also cover the world of streaming TV, and this week it's going to be a streaming TV special, a reality TV special. Most of reality TV is fake reality, but there are things about it that do reflect actual reality, and we're going to see what that intersection is this week. Rachel Llewellyn is going to be here to talk about Love is Blind, a recently concluded dating show, the eighth season of a recently concluded dating show on Netflix, and this season ended with a bit of a political controversy, and Rachel and I are going to unpack what that means for real-world relationships and real-world values. We have a very fun conversation coming up, and I'm also going to talk to a new contributor to the podcast. His name is Rick Ellis, and he has a Substack called Too Much TV. Like me, Rick watches way too much TV, and he watches way too much food TV, and we're going to talk about the changing landscape of culinary competition shows. I wrote a piece on Book and Film Globe talking about the decadent endgame of culinary competition shows. Rick doesn't seem to think that they're ending anytime soon. He's probably right. He watches even more TV than me. I didn't think that was possible, but I found someone, and he is going to be along to talk to me about food TV right after this interlude. Regular listeners of this podcast and regular readers of Book and Film Globe know that I'm obsessed about a lot of things regarding pop culture, but one of my major obsessions and interests is in food TV, and specifically food competition shows. I watch far too many of them. I spend way too much of my life watching chefs get eliminated and cook competitively. And I used to talk about that on the show with our contributor, our late contributor, Daniel Cohen, but obviously he is no longer available. And so I've been searching for someone in the universe who cares about this topic as much as I do. And I think I may have stumbled upon someone. His name is Rick Ellis, and he runs a Substack called Too Much TV. And I found a post by him the other day where he talks about sort of the decline of the Food Network's TV offerings. And he's here today to talk to me about what's going on in food competition TV. Hello, Rick.
Hi there. It's nice to talk to you.
Yes. Nice to talk to you as well. So, all right. So I wrote this piece in Book and Film Globe. I discussed what I consider to be sort of the decadent endgame of food competition TV, right? Like you have right now, Top Chef just debuted its 22nd season, which takes place somewhat ironically in Canada, a country that apparently the United States is now at war with, at least a cold war with. Top Chef is like, compared to the rest of food competition TV, right? Top Chef just kind of hovers above it all, right?
Yeah, I mean, it hovers above it all. Although, if you notice, the people who are on Top Chef ultimately end up doing a lot of things like the Food Network. It's sort of a giant cinematic universe of food, if you will.
Yeah, that's what I was pointing out, is like in terms of the production quality and the way the show is conducted, it is above. Although I did notice in the second episode of this week of the season, they had some kind of dumb like food sabotage thing that like was tired when Guy Fieri was doing it 10 years ago. They had to sabotage the other team by making them cook gourmet meals with like Red Hots or gummy bears or whatever. It's really, really bad.
Well, with any of these shows, after you've done a few seasons, they start messing around with it, trying to make it more, quote, exciting. Yeah. And usually that means some sort of stupid gimmick. I mean, even on this season's Next Level Chef, they're playing around with some stupid gimmicks and stuff. And it's just, I suppose it keeps the viewers happy, but man, it's tough to slog through sometimes.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you mentioned Next Level Chef. That is, Gordon Ramsay has sort of a sub branch of the food competition TV. He always has a show running on Fox. If it's not Next Level Chef, it's Master Chef or it's Hell's Kitchen. There's one for every season, and Next Level Chef is the current iteration. That is a show where there are chef contestants, and they have to cook in this tower, and there's three tiers. We've talked about this on the show before. There's a basement, a fake basement with crappy kitchen gear and bad equipment, and there's sort of an industrial-level kitchen, and then there's this high-end gourmet kitchen, and they compete. And it's nonsense, but I watch it anyway. And then you have sort of the third major prong of the food competition ecosystem. There's this Guy Fieri's Tournament of Champions. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? I know you're familiar with it.
Yeah, I mean, of the various shows, it's probably my favorite. Hmm. And it seems to be sort of the favorite of the people who are competing on it. Basically, it's expanded over the seasons. I think now they have 32 chefs competing, and it's one-on-one, heads-up, winner continues, kind of a traditional, think of a basketball tourney, but with chefs.
Right.
And he has a giant wheel where he spins around and lets people know, okay, you're going to have this amount of time. This is your protein. It's really straightforward. Luckily, Guy Fieri is really good at what he does on that show, which is just sort of standing there and being Guy Fieri.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to crack a lot of jokes like he does on some of his other shows. It's fairly straightforward cooking wise. There aren't a ton of gimmicks. I mean, the format itself is quote the gimmick. And as opposed to some of the things like Next Level Chef, these are all people that if you don't know their name, they're still someone who's been cooking for 8 or 10 or 15 years. They're not bringing on social media chefs. They're not bringing home cooks. This is just straightforward people who like to cook, and it forces them into cooking in the best they possibly can in that limited amount of time.
Well, they're more than people who like to cook. They're professional chefs, although I noticed that some of them kind of come up through the ranks. Like they appear, if you don't, for instance, if I don't watch Guy's Grocery Games, like I have only so many meals that I can watch TV in front of, so I don't watch Guy's Grocery Games. And there are characters who appear on Next Level Chef who apparently come up through the Guy's Grocery Games ecosystem. You know, sometimes it's like some of these people on the Tournament Champions are like, you know, restaurateurs, famous chefs who get cast and decide to try their mettle at competitive cooking. But some of them are like, it seems to me like they're really just kind of almost full-time competitive chefs. And this is what I complained about in my article, right? You have these people who they either come from Top Chef or they even work up their way from the ranks through Chopped, and they just become these sort of characters, these chef athletes. And I find myself thinking, what are we doing here?
Well, I mean, from the chef's perspective, being on TV is good. You know, it's expensive to promote your restaurant. Even established restaurants struggle, especially now, to get people in the door. And being able to say, oh, you saw this person on Chopped or Guy's Grocery Games or whatever it is, and they're getting paid a little bit of money to promote the restaurant. It's sort of a win-win for them. I mean, just as an example, and we weren't really talking about Chop, but here I live in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And recently, I guess 2 weeks ago, went to a watch party where a local chef who runs a small little Venezuelan restaurant was on Chop. She got a lot of local press coverage out of it. She did a watch party at a restaurant, and she's going on now to do some other shows. And yeah, there is a certain amount of, it's a fine line between you're going on a few times to promote your restaurant and suddenly you're, I don't want to pick out anybody by name, but there are certain people who are on a lot, but it's a good promotion.
Yeah, no, I get it. But the thing is, yeah, then yes, she's going on other shows. Sure, if you're on TV and you want to watch with your friends and customers, that's great. You know, it's like when I've been on game shows, and I've been on Jeopardy a couple of times, and I was on something else as well. And yeah, I watch those appearances with my friends, but then I don't use that there's no opportunity to use that as a springboard to then become like a professional quizzer, although a few people have managed to do it. But it's like suddenly they're not really chefs anymore. They're these TV creatures. And sure, it's I understand. Like, it's a lot easier. If you get a contract with the Food Network, it's a lot easier to make a living, you know, cooking for a couple of hours and, you know, talking to the camera for a couple hours than it is to try to manage a restaurant or a restaurant empire. I mean, I don't blame them. I would probably do the same thing. But I don't know. I just, as someone who like loves food and loves cooking and loves eating, I just find it a little depressing, I guess. Well, you know, Alton Brown was on, you know, a former creature of this ecosystem who has, you know, graduated basically, who freed himself, was on Nick Gillespie's Reason podcast. I watched his interview there, and he basically said, you know, that people don't know how to cook anymore, that they just watch competition shows. Food TV is no longer teaching people how to cook.
Well, that part is true, although from the perspective of the Food Network, you know, food programming is incredibly easy to produce.
Yeah.
You know, producing a show where someone's sitting there and cooking a meal, literally anyone could do that. I mean, and you'll see on some of the lesser cable networks and all these really obscure platforms, there's people doing cooking shows because it's stupid easy to do. I mean, it doesn't require a lot of money to produce it. You don't necessarily have to have some incredible charismatic chef, just someone who knows how to talk on camera. And so from the Food Network perspective, I think what they ended up deciding was the only way that we can differentiate ourselves, the only way that we can sort of be the quote destination for food people is to do something different, which is competitive TV. And they also have sort of built their own little empire of people who are tied to the Food Network. Because if there's 40 food shows out there, people tend to gravitate to ones where they know the chef, or they're familiar with it, they've seen him on TV.
Right.
And the Food Network's really good at promoting people. I mean, Rachael Ray has a deal with A&E, and no one watches those shows.
I didn't even know that. I was like, where is Rachael Ray these days, right?
Yeah, she signed a deal last year with A&E, and they have Fast Channel, which is basically one of these free channels like that runs on Pluto or Tubi. And she's doing shows for A&E. She's doing shows for one of their lesser cable networks, FYI. They paid her a fair amount of money, but like no one watches them. So that's the other thing that Food Network can bring to it is people are going to watch the show. Now, it may be fewer people than 10 years ago, but still.
Well, you mentioned that in your on your Substack, you talked about how there's kind of a decline in original programming. Like they're making less and less of this stuff.
Well, part of that is greed. Go figure.
Yeah.
You know, but probably next to the Hallmark Channel, Food Network and HGTV have the strongest TV brands where people will watch it just to watch it. Oh, I don't really care what's on the network. I'll just watch.
Yeah.
So executives at Warner Brothers Discovery, who now own Food Network, have decided, well, if we spend less money on original stuff, people won't really care. Yeah, there's not a new Guy's Grocery Games, but there's an old Guy's Grocery Games, and they're pretty much the same anyway, which works until it doesn't. And I think we're getting really close to the but it doesn't part of the equation.
Well, and this is what I refer to as the decadent endgame, right? And what's happening is they take these people from Top Chef land, people like Brooke Williamson or Antonia LoFaso. They take Iron Chefs like Alex Guarnaschelli, and they kind of just they lock them up for God knows how long. And then they make them do these ridiculous shows like Beachside Brawl or Bobby's Triple Threat. But the two that I really singled out in my article, and I don't know if you're familiar with these specific programs or not, is one called Wild Card Kitchen.
Right.
Which you that one you probably know. It's been on for a couple of seasons. And then there's this new thing that they have called House of Knives.
Right.
I don't know if you've have you encountered House of Knives yet?
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, is it a great show? It was, I will say it's better than what I expected to see.
Okay.
And they're sort of one of their gimmicks is they have people competing. They boot someone off of the show and then they bring on a replacement.
Right.
And so far, the replacements have been fairly recognizable names. So there have been a couple surprises so far. It's like, oh, I haven't seen this person compete recently. So it's not a classic of the genre, but it's watchable. While Wild Card Kitchen, I just find the most idiotic show in the world.
Well, Wild Card Kitchen is horrible, right? So Eric Agapong, who you know is an appealing TV presence, right, and a former Top Chef, not a winner, not a Top Chef winner, just like a cool guy who was on Top Chef. He's African. He's literally of African descent, although American. Very appealing on TV. He like the premise is that he has some kind of like man pad, like basement man pad in Manhattan. And the chefs come to his pad after hours to play a dangerous game of cards and food, betting their own money on what, which I can't imagine is their own money. You know, it's like, really, like these chefs are really going to be slapping down $10,000 to prove that they can make the best breakfast for dinner. I'm like, come on.
Well, apparently it's their own money in that. The producers give them the money, and then if they have it left, they get to keep it. So technically, it's their money, although it's not like they're pulling it out of their pocket.
Because, you know, that would be, if it were really their own money, I think the show would actually get a lot more intense, you know? And then you'd get to see who of these chefs really is successful, you know? I don't know. I just feel like it's too many levels of artifice. You know, House of Knives, they're like competing to sit on the throne, which is really just kind of like a repurposed like airport massage chair. You know, Scott Conant, who is a chopped judge, is hosting this thing, but he just looks and acts like he really doesn't want to be there. Like, this is just like, I mean, how... Maybe he's under contract. I don't know. But I can't imagine like what they had to pay him.
Yeah, Scott Conant, he has this look like it's part of a hostage situation.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
And you know, he's obviously reading off of cue cards. And he really can't deliver what is supposed to be some sort of, not joke, but wry comment. It's super, super awkward.
Right.
You know, and just one thing about Wild Card Kitchen, part of the reason that I don't like the show, and this is my own problem because I've just watched a blank load of TV over the years.
Yeah.
There used to be a network called Esquire Network. That was named after the magazine about 10 years ago. And short-lived, but they did a ton of really interesting food shows. And they did this one called something like, you know, After Hours Kitchen Battle or something like that. And the premise was it's after hours, local chefs come in and they compete against each other one-on-one. And it was done in this studio. It was done after hours. It was like in this little kitchen area. There was a crowd in there basically standing next to the chefs. It was a really cool idea. And then I see Wild Card Kitchen, which is the exact opposite of the same idea. And it's really hard for me to watch that and not think, no, there's a much better format out there if you guys would just embrace it.
Well, but again, like this is what it drives me crazy about contemporary food TV is the artificiality of it, the surreal reality of it in some ways. I just feel like I've been trying desperately to find someone for years to help me like write a parody of it, produce a parody of it, because it's just so bad. And so it's just so incestuous. And I mean, I can't stop watching it, but I'm tired of it at the same time. You know, and I was like one of the avatars of hope for me in food TV has always been America's Test Kitchen, right? Yeah. Like they have a streaming channel on Pluto or wherever you watch free streaming TV where you're just watching old episodes of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country and whatever. And it's a TV show, but they're actually instructing you on how to cook, sort of presenting steps and recipes. And then you pointed out in your blog post that they have a competition show too.
Yeah, a second season of that's coming. And honestly, I mean, it's not terrible as these shows go. And the person who won season one is part of the America's Test Kitchen, quote, family now. Mm-hmm. So at least there's a thing. I mean, the America's Test Kitchen is hilarious because, you know, the first 10 years of the show, they had a host who got in a huge legal battle with him.
Yeah.
He's now created his own network of things. And they recently did an anniversary show for PBS. And it was hilarious to watch them not mention
it. Yeah, Christopher Kimball.
They would cut video from back then where you couldn't see him. The closest they got at one point was Bridget, who's one of the two sort of main characters now on the show, basically saying, oh, well, when we started hosting, you started hosting because this other guy got sued. But it's funny, any show like that, they're 25 years into this. So they have almost the same kind of back history an episode of NCIS has.
Yeah, I just feel like, I don't know, Anthony Bourdain is rolling over in his grave. You know, this is everything he didn't want.
But it is, although, you know, Anthony Bourdain is also like, he loved Guy Fieri, apparently. He thought Guy Fieri, the person, was a blowhard, but he apparently, from interviews I've seen, loved sort of what Guy Fieri did.
Oh, I don't have any problem with Guy Fieri as a personality. I don't eat at one of his airport restaurants if you want to live. But you know, Diners, Drive-ins, and Dives is perfectly adequate. But that's also just like a here's a wacky sandwich to eat show, and that's very different. It's a very different kind of show than these food competition shows that are just like, I just feel like every other show on TV is a food competition. And I don't know, like I don't know if you cook or not, but like we make dinner almost every night, and it's not a competitive sport. And at a certain point, I'm tired of watching these pro chefs like take each other on in these totally fake battles.
Well, you know, the fake battle, I mean, I think honestly that the battles themselves sort of are real. The thing that I really dislike, and there's someone on the new season of Tournament of Champions, this guy, he's been on a couple other shows, and his stick is that basically he just trash talks everybody.
Yeah.
And I find that incredibly off-putting.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, look, these people are all your equal or better. So trash talking, I realize it's part of the genre, but that really is a big turnoff for me. I mean, I will literally turn a show off if there's too much of it, because I get the artifice of the battle, but look, I don't need to be, you know, pro wrestling.
Right. If you want to watch trash talking, watch wrestling. Cooking is not wrestling. And, you know, because of that, I feel like the genre is, maybe it's not doomed to fail, but it, I just find it extremely, I'm upset by it. I don't know why exactly. There's something about it that just doesn't taste good to me.
But at the end of the day, you're watching it, see? So they've accomplished it. Yeah.
God damn it. I'm such a sucker. I'm such a sucker. All right. Rick Ellis has an excellent website, a Substack called Too Much TV, and you should check it out. And he was very kind to join me today to talk about one of my the topics of that I'm a little over-obsessed about. Rick, thank you so much. You can pack your knives and go.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
When the doors opened and I saw him, I thought, he's so familiar to me. I believe he knew exactly what I looked like the entire time we were talking through the wall.
I think half of us could leave for engaged. Hunger Games, baby.
Why do you need a prenup?
It's a big decision.
Oh, God. I can't deal with this for the rest of my life.
Ah, get me out of here.
We have already been through 8 seasons of the TV dating show Love is Blind. It's hard to imagine that only 5 years ago I was watching the first season of Love is Blind just before COVID hit. And I wrote about it. We were so innocent back then in 2000, where we thought it would be so easy to find love anonymously by sitting in a pod presided over by Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey. How naive we were. Season 8 has just concluded, and it was probably the most controversial season yet. And Rachel Llewellyn wrote about it for us, and she's here today to talk to me about the controversy surrounding the new season of Love is Blind. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me, Neil.
Always a pleasure. So, you know, this is somewhat ironic because you and I have actually never met in person. I don't remember exactly how you came to write for Book and Film, but we weren't sitting in pods. I think maybe you just sent me an email or something like that, or a Facebook message. Maybe you remember.
Yes, it was remote, but I don't think politics became involved at any point in our personal interaction, but that seems to be kind of shifting over the past few years, don't you think?
Well, not in our personal interaction, but in many, many interactions.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't really care what people's politics are for the most part. I mean, I suppose there are a few red flags or dividing lines, but they have to be pretty extreme for me to care. But that's not the case with the contestants on Love is Blind. You wrote about this, and I think it's worth talking about. So tell me a little bit about what went down in this season.
Well, season 8 got a whole lot of headlines outside of its usual, you know, fandom when the season 8 finale aired, and it showed two of the female contestants rejecting their male partners over their ambivalence over, you know, political and religious issues. Sarah Carton, one of the contestants, went all the way to the altar with her fiance, Ben Mazenga, and, you know, just could not, I think, get on the same wavelength was her word about his, you know, views about Black Lives Matter, vaccines, and, you know, the LGBTQ community. So she said, you know, can't do this. And another female contestant, Virginia Miller, also turned down her partner, Devin Buckley, because he was pretty passive and non-leaning, you know, about the way he votes. So that's pretty much what happened. And fans were agog. Producers said, hey, we didn't plan this. We planned this show. We set it up so that people suss out these, you know, deep ideological divides early on and it doesn't come to this. But I'm kind of wondering if that dynamic may change based on the fact that you and I, who, you know, I don't really watch this show, we're writing and talking about it.
Well, not just you and I either. I mean, it was the reason like you and I are talking about it and you wrote about it is because it went ballistic on Twitter. And you had, I saw conservatives saying, boy, he really dodged a bullet. Talk about the guy who got dumped at the altar specifically, because the second one was a slightly less... slightly less divided. And then I saw liberals saying, girl, you dodged a bullet. You know, it's like, and it may be true. They may have dodged a bullet. They may have both dodged bullets, but it's just, it was shocking to me, like how ideological, I mean, I haven't dated since the 90s. So what do I know? But, you know, how ideological and fraught dating has become. It's like, because this guy, I mean, Black Lives Matter doesn't even exist as an organization anymore, you know? It's like, and so this guy doesn't support them and she dumps him? It makes no sense.
There are so many frameworks we lay over relationship dynamics that are playing out in this show. I mean, we could look at it, you know, as far as how men perceive women with political views and how women perceive men with strong political views, you know, whether that's positive or negative. You could look at it, you know, like, again, the framework through politics. And it's interesting to me because, like you said, it's been a while since I've dated. But what was interesting to me is the context of media, the platform of being behind a camera, being filtered through a screen. And I think that that is a huge factor in this dynamic playing out. It's a platform that's designed to amplify our engagement through our emotions. You know, television and social media do that. And it's not a great bellwether for really measuring cultural sentiment. You know, right. Half of unmarried couples are living with someone of a different religious faith. And about 40% of married couples are of different faiths. And that includes myself and my spouse and yourself and your spouse, as I know.
Yeah, I'm Jewish and my wife is, I mean, nominally Presbyterian, but, but both of us kind of dabble in alternative modes of spirituality. Yeah. You know, I went to yoga school. I'm not allowed to talk about Regina's spiritual path in print or on podcasts, but let's just say that, you know, yeah, they're different. But, you know, part of being in a relationship to me is about learning how to accept and even embrace difference with your partner. You don't, sure, there are some values that are not compatible, but like, why do you don't want to marry yourself? I mean, some people do maybe, but that's generally not what people are looking for.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do think it's a shame that politics has sort of filtered down to that interpersonal level to, you know, the point that where national issues that have traditionally stood in opposition for decades, like, you know, Roe versus Wade, immigration, they've become these really emotionally charged, almost maybe ethical filters that are supposed to give you deep insights into a person's, you know, individual character and qualities, like a sorting hat. And I think that's an overly simplistic way of dealing with it. And I think what we're seeing play out on television, in the media, and I think a little bit in Love is Blind is a bit of a performative aspect. And I think that's important to remember that this is a TV show. People have sure. investments and people, you know, have motives and agendas and things that we don't see behind the scenes, and a lot of different stakeholders wanting something out of this show. So I think we should interpret it as well through that filter. And I do agree with what you said. You know, there's conflict avoidance, which is normal. You don't want to have these huge clashes over things that are going to affect your relationship, like birth control or raising children. I mean, those are going to directly impact you. But there's conflict avoidance, and then there's just complexity avoidance.
And I feel like they were not, you know, these were like almost memeable differences. They were like differences based on social media feeds, as opposed to like, you know, these are Love is Blind contestants we're talking about. Yeah. So, I mean, how deep could their ideas about, you know, LGBTQ, whatever rights be, you know, how well informed could these people possibly be about the politics of Black Lives Matter or the COVID vaccine? You know, probably not very, is what I'm there. If they're, you know, I assume that Love is Blind people are like slightly more narcissistic than the average person, but still somewhat reflective of your basic American, right?
I would say they've got to be if they're going to be watched and commented on so universally. But at the same time, I see another dynamic playing out in reality, which is that, you know, people are understanding that there is nuance and context and complexity to personalities. And, you know, there's this really wonderful therapist, her name's Raquel Hopkins, and she said, if your well-being depends on cutting people off and avoiding negativity or controlling your environment, you don't really have, you know, stability or equilibrium. You have a pretty fragile setup that only works as long as circumstances go your way, as far as you can control them. Yeah. And while I understand that personal relationships, that is obviously a controllable area, I think people really shut themselves off to a lot of dialogue and really weaken their own ideas by not testing them against ideological resistance. You know, it's like any other muscle. You have to work it against resistance to strengthen it. And I think that there is, you know, cutting off that dialogue preemptively, really robs us of a lot of enrichment and insight from other human beings that we can take and leave other things. So I think it's really kind of simplified and cartoonized the debate.
I'm going to quote that to my wife the next time I express some climate change skepticism.
And by the way, I want to say, I think it's really wonderful that you and your wife have established a boundary where you respect her to, you know, be, you know, protective of her personal beliefs and what she wants to protect. I think that's wonderful. And that's a sign of true love.
Well, I'm, you know, I don't have an ideological litmus test. I mean, I would say like if for some reason, you know, my wife, who is, you know, this kindest, sweetest person in the world, would somewhere along the line just become some kind of virulent racist, anti-Semite, you know, whatever. Yeah, yeah, that might be a dividing line, but it's also like it's
deal breaker.
It's simply not possible. But I do think that these things, they exist in the real world. Like I had a friend just this weekend. I will not name this person or anything about them, but I was communicating with her, and you know, she has been cut off from a cousin, like a close family member, because she refuses to sell her Tesla, you know? And it's like, but that's like bubble related thinking, right? Like this person is not a fascist. First of all, Tesla is not a fascist company, but beyond that could be debated, but this person is definitely not a Nazi, you know?
Yeah. The insularity is kind of distressing to me. Because if we agree that a lot of things in our lives are fluid, and can change over time, I think that things like ideologies can evolve and change with time, experience, and information. Yeah. If we're no longer willing to exchange that information, you know, we're at a loss as to how we're supposed to exchange these things and change and really evolve. It's a process. It's not a static thing. And treating ideological beliefs like a static thing can really preemptively cut off a lot of healthy and important dialogue.
That said, do you think that these Love is Blind contestants dodged a bullet?
Look, dating's going to be a minefield under like the absolute best circumstances. Yeah. I think in these circumstances, I think they could have made it work. I do mention in my article that the Sarah Carton and her fiance Ben were in contact after the altar scene where she left him, and they had made plans to kind of hook up a little later, but it ended up not coming to fruition. But that's why I say these things should kind of be taken within the context of a TV show, because people know people are watching, and they may actually have views that they're afraid or, you know, noncommittal about because they don't want to share them. Again, because of that environment that kind of freezes that sort of thing out and, you know, preempts any kind of exchange of ideas. So I think it was a shame, and I think they could have gone further with their relationships had they not done that.
Yeah, I would like to see a dating show where people actually who have completely different points of view on things actually try to get together.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I'm in a relationship with someone who is, you know, very conservative, and I kind of started out on the left end of the spectrum. I mean, you know, liberal arts university, I worked at a lesbian magazine. And so there's a lot of, you know, fluidity, change, information that we can absorb from people. And I think it's all part of the, you know, rich experience of life.
Yes, you and I are both in ideologically diverse relationships, let us say. So
so how do you do it? Do you have any advice for me? How do you make it work? Or any advice for those listening to the podcast that might have some conflicts with their significant other?
I would say that if things get really dicey talking-wise, like a cooking competition is always nice to watch. Although there are some politics that come up, but it's mostly like you can't find like entertainment that you can either both hate watch or enjoy watch together. That always helps. Go for a hike. Hiking is an ideological neutral activity. Also, like, you know, just have a discussion and stay up too late yelling at each other until you're both too exhausted to fight anymore, and then go to bed and cuddle with the dog. That's usually works pretty well. I don't know if that would make for good TV, but it's reality. You know, my parents, my mother was a former beatnik. My father was a Nixon Republican. They survived until they didn't, but it wasn't because of their politics.
Yeah. And I'd like to get rid of that narrative that if you, you know, don't have the same faith, if you don't have the same views, it's just going to be a no right off the bat. You know, the only thing that's a deal breaker is if you have no opinion. If you genuinely have no opinion, you know. That's for me.
Yeah, you don't want to be with someone who's dumb.
Exactly. And I feel like that's how a lot of these guys were portrayed. Both of the men were portrayed as being kind of dense or ignorant. And again, I didn't read that. I read that they were being purposely concealing their opinions because they knew that they were not popular, frankly, on that platform.
Yeah, you want to be with someone who's engaged with the world, you know, and the thing that makes a relationship hum is, what do they call it? Frisson in French, you know, like little tension's good. It keeps things lively. Yeah, it may not be like a surprise date night, but, you know, a little argument has the same, sometimes can have the same effect. Just a little ideological spark never hurt anyone. All right. Well, Rachel Llewellyn, good talk. You know, despite whatever differences we might have, as contributors to Book and Film Globe, thank you so much for your, very thoughtful and politically amorphous contributions.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much, Rachel Llewellyn, frequent contributor, friend of the site. Love is Blind is now on Netflix, now and forever, probably. And thanks to Rick Ellis for stopping by to talk to me about food competition TV. You can find those shows pretty much everywhere on TV. I watch the Gordon Ramsay shows on Hulu, but they're on Fox. I watch the Food Network shows on Sling, but they're on the Food Network, ostensibly. I watch Top Chef on Peacock, although it is technically on Bravo. Look, this is a very strange time to be consuming content. You just kind of click on an app and hope that there's something there that you want to watch. And occasionally you watch stuff on the antenna too. I watch the NCAA tournament on TV using an antenna. I watch Jeopardy on TV using an antenna. I put an antenna on my head. I put a tinfoil hat on my head and TV streams straight into my brain. At least that's what it feels like sometimes. I am Neil Pollack. I am the greatest living American writer. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are a product of Sea of Reeds Media, which owns two independent bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn and the Bookhouse in Long Branch on the Jersey Shore. Please check them out or use the Bookhouse as your affiliate link on bookshop.org, which is your independent place to buy independent, or at least independently minded, literature on the internet. And we encourage you, even if you are watching nothing but food competition TV shows most of the time, to read a book now and then. It's good for the brain, it's good for the soul, it's good for you. Thanks so much for listening to the show. I will talk to you next week.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.